Last episode, we looked at how abortion became illegal in the first place and took you from 1500 BC through 1910. This time, we look at the deliberate plan that set the stage for abortion to become legal. The platform for the landmark Roe v. Wade case. It's mostly due to this one guy, and that is next. Hey, welcome back to the Barry Farrow Show. Before Roe v. Wade became the law of the land, abortion was illegal. Yet there was a deliberate plan to make it legal. It was unlikely to work, but the proponents of abortion threw a long bomb, and they were successful. Last episode, we discussed the five camps of abortion belief. These five camps more or less describe everyone's belief around the issue of abortion. The first camp believes that abortion's always morally wrong unless the abortion is solely to prevent the death of the mother. The second camp believes that abortion's mostly morally wrong, but that when competing with other morally bad outcomes, an abortion's the lesser of two evils. But like the first camp, this camp believes abortion is morally wrong as a means of birth control, family planning, sex selection, or convenience. The third camp believes that abortion's mostly morally okay, up to about the midpoint in the pregnancy. After that, it's maybe wrong. This camp believes abortion's acceptable after considering the mental and physical condition of the birth mother, her economic situation, potential disabilities, but most controversially of all, as a backup plan to failed contraception or birth control. The fourth camp does not believe that abortion on demand is morally wrong at all. To this camp of believers in abortion, abortion's not morally wrong until it's likely that the baby would survive outside of the womb naturally. And then the fifth camp believes that abortion's morally right under any circumstances. This camp believes abortion on demand is good. It solves problems like overpopulation. This camp includes all the way up to partial birth. And some in this camp believe abortion on demand is morally right, even if immediately after the baby's already fully born. Now, with modern science, ultrasound technology, and super high definition video technology, many have moved from camp 3 to camp 2. The people in camp 1 and 2 are generally unwavering. It's a belief. And the people in camp 4 and 5, they've thought about it too, and they're usually unmovable. There are a few exceptions, but and we're actually going to mention one today. He actually changed from camp 5 to camp 2. He was the nation's leading abortionist at the time. But for the most part, people in camp 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 are true believers. They're just on complete opposite sides of the spectrum. So let's pick up where we left off last episode. In England, Queen Victoria reigned from 1837 to 1901. This is known as the Victorian Age. Britain was the world's superpower. In fact, 1/4 of the world's population was under the rule of this 4-foot-11-inch queen. The world experienced crazy amounts of change. It was the world's first industrial revolution. There was tremendous political reform and massive social change. Charles Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol and Oliver Twist, inspiring both generosity and compassion and a culture of Christian celebration. On the other side of the spectrum, Charles Darwin wrote Origin of the Species, challenging a need for a creator. Later, astrophysics proved scientifically that there is indeed a first cause, thus a beginning. It's about 14.6 billion years ago. Thus, you would need a beginner, like a creator. And Darwin himself had some self-doubt. For example, the macroevolution concept is kind of logically weak when you observe things like the eye, with all its complexity. He talked about that. It's a reach to think that less complex things can evolve into more complex ones. Regardless, the notion that you could even entertain that there was not a creator upset the apple cart, and it was a marker for evangelicals to fight back, and they created the fundamentalist movement in 1920 as a result. There was also a famine in Ireland. Over 1 million people died. Another 1 million people moved to America and Great Britain. Concurrently, there were inventions left and right. False teeth, farm machinery, telescopes, the telephone, and the expansion of transportation technology, especially the railroad. There was also war. The French and the Brits joined against Russia to defend Christians who were being slaughtered by the Ottomans. The famous nurse Florence Nightingale helped reduce the death rate by improving hygiene. It was during this era that the United States was growing in all directions. It was not a world power yet, but it was changing socially as fast as it was technologically. Famous preachers of the era warned against slavery, and they demanded slave-owning Christians to repent or to risk a bloody war. Some heeded the exhortation, but not near enough, and as predicted, there was a bloody civil war. The psyche of America was a bit complicated. Here, our system of government was that we, the people, agreed on what would be the law of the land, and we would effectively rule ourselves. On the one hand, a prominent American idea was to let people make their own decisions, especially on matters of morality. On the other hand, the Victorian age ushered in a dogma against what was perceived to be evil. In many respects, dogma from the government on issues of morality really is a flawed idea. You can see this, for example, with the Prohibition movement. Many people believed you could be a moral person and still enjoy an adult beverage. You just can't legislate what most people do not think is immoral. But what about the moral issues of human rights? In this arena, where there should be mostly agreement, the government is supposed to step in and execute justice and protect the innocent. So the question on what the government should do about abortion would have to come down to some rendition of an answer to the question, when does life begin? The reality is that Protestants in the United States were not politically vocal about abortion in the 1800s, really hardly at all. They were very vocal about their opposition to slavery, but abortion was just not a hot button issue for them, really through the middle of the 1800s. After all, people died young. Miscarriages were common. Everyone knew someone at a young age who had died. And you had this widespread belief in the concept of the quickening. This is when the mother is pregnant enough that everyone can notice it and mom can feel it. It's defined as between 14 and 26 weeks. If you hadn't felt the first kick from the girl or the boy in your tummy, there was no broadly understood credible science that proved that there was life there. The quickening concept made sense to most people. We had no ultrasound. But at the quickening, you can see the belly in the mommy, and you can feel the baby moving around. You kind of know at that time that it's alive. So once the baby's alive, Protestants would certainly agree that you can't abort it. But up until that time, most did not give it that much thought and did not think pre-quickening that it was wrong to have an abortion. But the Catholics had really thought it through. And they laid out some logic and some biblical support. They were convinced that abortion was evil, and except for the life of the mother, they were convinced that they needed to implement an effective all-out campaign to make abortion illegal in the United States. And by 1910, they had been successful. That was the case. But a counterforce, a powerful counterforce, was developing. And his name was Larry Leder. But you can't know Larry unless you know Margaret Sanger. She was born in 1879 in New York. She had 10 siblings. Her dad was an atheist and an activist. Margaret was a nurse. Her husband was an architect. They both became active socialists. In 1911, she wrote on sex education in the socialist magazine, The New York Call. Her style was direct and explicit, pretty much on the edge at that time. Margaret was deeply impacted from her nurse work, where she met women who had self-induced abortions. She threw herself into helping women with contraception. She personally opposed abortion. She thought the public health danger of abortion would just fade away if women were just allowed a way to prevent unwanted pregnancy through birth control up front. But birth control was largely illegal, and the government censored information on contraceptives. So she launched a campaign to fix that. In 1914, now separated from her husband, who 7 years later she got divorced from, she launched the Woman Rebel. Not exactly subtle. She had friends who were anarchists, and they helped her get the monthly newsletter launched. This is where she first used the term birth control. She was actually indicted for violating postal obscenity laws. Can you believe it? So she fled the country and continued her work from England. Here she developed more justifications for birth control: overpopulation, famine, war, and poverty. Overpopulation would be one of her keynote top concerns until her death in 1966. Her second husband became the first legal manufacturer of diaphragms in the United States. She became a nationally known sex educator, things died down, she moved back, and birth control activist. She started the first birth control clinic and established organizations that eventually evolved into Planned Parenthood. She was opposed to abortion. But since she supported eugenics and reproductive rights And since her disciples were so strongly in support of abortion, she is sometimes wrongly confused with being pro-abortion. She believed proper contraception was the only safe and responsible way to avoid abortions. Having said that, the American Birth Control League, which she did found in 1921, became Planned Parenthood in 1942. And Planned Parenthood has presided over more abortions in the United States than anyone. Margaret died in 1966. This was just 1 year after the Supreme Court legalized birth control. And that was her issue. That was her life message. And she felt she died victorious. She was radical for her time. But at the end of the day, she was against abortion and for birth control. And by 2018, only 6% of the U.S. population thought birth control to be morally wrong. So why is she credited by the leading proponents of abortion as their forerunner? Well, she would certainly be opposed to Planned Parenthood's support of late-term and partial birth abortions, and most certainly opposed to the gruesome trafficking of the organs of aborted babies. Larry Leder enters. He's this early disciple of Margaret Sanger. And in multiple settings, he said that the greatest influence in his life was Margaret. He said that she was his mentor and he learned everything from her. He was a public relations guru and a manipulator and a conniver. He knew her position on contraceptives was very popular nationally, and he linked the right to abortion on demand to birth control, thus linking himself to her. Larry Leder was the driving force behind the team of savvy influencers and lawyers who got New York legislature to legalize abortion all the way up to 24 weeks, which would be kind of the time of the quickening, in 1970. So New York had it all the way through 24 weeks in 1970. Abortion was legal in New York. He was the guy who had a bold, audacious plan to make abortion legal nationwide. He wanted to take the established precedent from New York and find a test case somewhere else that would get appealed and roll it all the way up to the Supreme Court and use that New York precedent as part of the ammunition. He wanted to take advantage of the current leanings of the Supreme Court, and he wanted to get abortion on demand legalized nationally. He wanted to quash the state laws. That was his plan. Larry and Dr. Bernard Nathanson implemented this audacious plan. Larry was a prolific author. He lived from 1919 to 2006, and he's considered by most people to be the modern father of the abortion movement. Dr. Bernard Nathanson was a friend of his and a medical doctor and a very strong abortion advocate before he changed his mind. He had presided over about 60,000 abortions. And at the time, he made about $20 million from that practice. And this was the late 60s and early 70s. So cumulative inflation since 1970 is 650%. So that would have amounted to $130 million today. So while Dr. Nathanson was hauling in the cash, Larry Leder was just being shrewd and conniving. He knew a lot of big names, and he was able to persuade them to come along with his crazy, outlandish goal to make it the law of the land for abortion on demand. The states were just too cumbersome, and they took too long, and some were just a lock for the pro-life movement. He'd never get them to change. Larry grew up in privilege and had time and money on his hands. And he put both into this massive strategy of making abortion available on demand. He just hated traditional morals, believed in the sexual revolution and the campaign to limit human population. In his mind, abortion was a legitimate plan B for contraception not working and a fantastic plan to reduce population. And killing unwanted babies helped with reducing poverty as well. So he was a Camp 5 guy. Abortions to him were actually morally good. Leder was also a professed Machiavellian, where the ends justify the means. In fact, he's kind of proud of it. In other words, whatever it took to get the job done was fine, and he even bragged about it. He did not have ethical boundaries at all. He felt the cause was too important to allow fact and law to interfere with his goal. He was the visionary, he was the leader, and the master manipulator. And having the media on his side, he could fabricate information and they would just run with it. Most of the time, he simply would use his friend and partner in the campaign, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, as the source. So he'd have a drink with him, talk about what he wanted to do in this next public relations campaign, and go to the doctor and say, look, I want you to kind of say this, all right? And lo and behold, the doctor would come out with a statement on how safe and good abortions were, kind of like a Dr. Fauci type, but without the social media or alternative media to challenge anything he said. So before the 1970 legislature ruled for abortion, Larry later needed to convince Betty Friedan, the president and co-founder of the National Organization of Women, now, to make abortion a central feature of their emerging women's movement. Now, she really didn't want to do that. She thought that would minimize the larger goal of equal access to the executive suite, but later persisted. It was essential the women's movement be the public face of the abortion movement if it was going to succeed. And Friedan's cooperation was key. It took actually years for him to convince Betty Friedan, but she ultimately relented. And once she was on board, she brought the gravitas needed to convince Hollywood and all the establishment media. First, Larry used her support to convince the ultra-immoral Hugh Hefner to support abortion in Playboy magazine. This was quite the irony, the epitome of objectivizing a person, scantily clad, if at all, women, in support of equal access to a sophisticated job on Wall Street. Kind of nutso. But since they were also in support of abortion, it made the real point clear. You can enjoy sex as a woman, and if birth control doesn't work, abortion is a suitable backup plan for you. Don't fear. No adverse consequences. With Friedan on board, the mainstream media campaign would provide support of abortion throughout the 1960s. Sitcoms referenced abortion as if it was a simple, non-emotional transaction, effectively reducing it to something just a little bit more painful than clipping your fingernails. There's no lasting emotional impact of abortion. It's just fine. It's harmless. Larry later had become a Marxist during his time at Harvard. He was a passionate guy about really everything he did, and he wanted to tear down the traditional moral fabric of the United States. In fact, later said that legalizing abortion would strike at the whole system of sexual morality, kind of kill it. He was always a step ahead of the pro-life movement. Later got some liberal church leaders to support abortion on demand. This gave his side the influence of ministers of higher law that would go in magazines like Time. One of the ministers of higher law, Reverend Howard Moody of the Judson Memorial Church, was ideologically an absolute ally of Larry Later's. He advocated for unrestricted freedom of sexual expression and its corollary, unrestricted access to abortion. Not sure what Bible he was reading from, but it wasn't mine. He aspired to this new and radical autonomy for men and women and even for children. Guy was pretty gross, but that was the kind of support he got, and it came from a church. So it sounded to the average public working out in the field that it was legit and that the guy was credible. So just before Betty Friedan died, she looked at all these things and expressed regret for all these extra consequences that were way in addition to her narrative. Margaret didn't live to see the ending, but she was not pro-abortion on demand, as Larry repeatedly said she was. So how did Dr. Bernard Nathanson help in all this campaign? Well, he was the official voice of the medical community. Dr. Nathanson acknowledged that later was this creator of what he thought, based on everything he had seen in all of his life, was one of the most brilliant strategies of all time. And there's two reasons for this. First, Larry created Dr. Bernard Nathanson as this leading expert on safety and the relative non-invasiveness of abortion. Out of nowhere, he became the national guru just because Larry said so. Dr. Nathanson had said that abortion didn't hurt, that the baby felt no pain, and that there really weren't any adverse consequences. He made abortion legit. Now, later, when he changed his mind, he confessed that he just made all that up. But we'll get to that next episode. Second, Larry's well-crafted messages and taglines kept Catholics out of the debate. Not totally, but largely they kept one of the most formidable opponents at the time out of the public square. Remember, the Catholics were the ones that made abortion illegal in this country to start with. Catholics had been the ones who were at the head of that campaign. But just 60 years later, Larry later figured out how to keep them more or less quiet. Catholics, way more than Protestants at this time, in history, had a very strong and sound message on the moral and the logical reason that abortion is wrong. But Larry got in front of them with stunningly successful public relations. The women had a right to her own body. Only 15% of Catholics at the time still believed that contraceptives were wrong. So that was a real statistic. And then he inserted, just making it up out of thin air, that the same amount of people were actually against abortion. Only 15% of Catholics are against abortion. 85% are for it. So the media ran with that. This is a statistic that was from nowhere. So 85% of Catholics don't think abortion's bad. So the Catholic leadership, they were just outflanked among their congregants. Larry connivingly made it widely easy for a priest to say the following: although I personally would not make that choice, I will not judge another person's right to do so. And that statement was actually fed to them, but they thought it was their own. And this was the brilliant campaign. Have a doctor who has performed more abortions than anyone else say that they're simple, they're safe, and they're easy. And have the most powerful organization on the planet that's against abortion stay off the field. Larry later had removed the social stigma from getting an abortion. In fact, his book, Abortion, was referenced in the 1973 Roe versus Wade decision 7 times. He knew those judges were on his side. He'd go on to promote abortion on demand all the way up until his death in 2006. Now, his buddy and associate Dr. Bernard Nathanson co-founded the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, but the doctor made his money as the director of New York's Center for Reproductive Health and Sexual Health, and at the time, it was the largest abortion clinic in the world. In 1970 to 1973, he was proud of his role in conducting tens of thousands of abortions. He gained national attention for his role in the legalization of abortion. He thinks he presided over 60,000 of them. Larry Later and Dr. Bernard Nathanson would quote each other as sources. They worked with the media directly, and they had an enormous impact on setting the stage for Roe versus Wade. Larry died wanting more abortions. Dr. Nathanson died in 2011 regretting that there was ever one abortion. So the time frame of 1910 through 1970 sets the stage for Roe versus Wade to have this outcome that the proponents wanted. Next time, we're going to look at the drama of the actual 1972 and 1973 time frame, where there's a leak. There's actually 2 leaks that impacted Roe versus Wade. We're going to talk about how Norma, the real Jane Roe, became a pro-life advocate. And we're going to discuss Dr. Bernard Nathanson's conversion, his about-face, and his quest to undo all the harm that he unleashed. Until then, to your freedom.
Hi, I'm David Farah. Thank you for listening to my dad's podcast, The Barry Farah Show, Culture Shift. Click subscribe now to be sure you don't miss an episode. Share this podcast with your friends on social media and give The Barry Farah Show your 5-star rating. See you next time.